This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. It's hard to say why some films get a cult following. And it's never the blockbusters, by the way. It's the more obscure films. And a lot of the time, they're really, really good or just really, really terrible. Sometimes they get cult status because of the inside jokes or for the subculture they portray. And maybe that's what explains how SLC Punk got its following. The director and former Salt Lake City resident James Mirandino made the film on a shoestring budget. It was the opening night feature at Sundance in 1999. It's about two punk rockers, Steve-O and Heroin Bob, living and hanging out in Salt Lake City in the 1980s, rebelling against yuppie culture and middle-class conformity. Next week, we're going to be screening the film as a kind of 20th anniversary celebration for SLC Punk. Mirandino will join us in a moment. But first, let's talk about the punk scene in Salt Lake City in the 1980s. John Schumann was in the thick of it then. He was part of a band called the Massacre Guys. These days, he's a prosecutor in the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office, but we wanted to talk to him about the punk scene, such as it was. I guess let me start really broadly. What was the scene like? Was it a scene?
Not really. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, my point of reference time-wise is probably 1979-ish to about 1985. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, when I say we, I mean my brother and the guys who ended up becoming the Massacre Guys at the time. I mean, we were all high school kids.
Yeah.
And we were not... There was not like a bar scene or a nightclub kind of scene for us. So it was really just a sort of like-minded kids hanging out. Like my son now is 13 and he comes home and gets online and plays video games with his friends. We would come home and we'd save our money and buy records and just listen to records and play music. That's what we did after school.
So there wasn't necessarily a place where dozens and dozens of punk kids gathered. It wasn't that big.
Not at that time.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you really pretty much knew everybody. Hmm. There were, you know, maybe a dozen, couple dozen.
Yeah.
There were certainly some little hot spots. There was a guy named Steve McAllister who would have house parties where, like, the Atheists and the Boards would play, and we kind of looked up to them because they were the old, cool punk rock bands. And there was a little place called the Roxy on Main Street that was right by where American Towers is now, a little basement kind of bar. And Steve did sound there, and he would sometimes let us sneak in through the kitchen, and we'd kind of hide and try to avoid, you know, getting anybody in trouble.
Because you were high school kids.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So we were pretty, you know, curious about this scene. And we also just wanted to write our own music. Mm. You know, we'd all kind of played in high school cover bands and done, you know, our Lynyrd Skynyrd songs and things like that.
Right.
And we were ready, you know, wanted to try writing our own songs.
Tell me about the band, the Massacre Guys.
So Massacre Guys was kind of started as a joke. My brother and I, my dad lived in Phoenix at the time. My parents had split up and we were in Phoenix and didn't really have much to do. So we were hanging around his office, and there was a copying machine, and we made a fanzine all about fictional punk rock bands.
Wow.
And that was just a name of a made-up band. So there was the Massacre Guys, the Manly Tomatoes, the Mod Fathers. There were these and we would write these fake, you know, record reviews and concert reviews. And also spending the summer down there, we got to see, you know, like the Meat Puppets and JFA and Butthole Surfers and some of the kind of the bands around that scene. So that was kind of eye-opening too. And then when we came back to Salt Lake, that's how I met Stefan, a.k.a. Steve-O, and Carl Alvarez. They were at East High in the theater department, in the drama department. And we were all kind of got to be friends that way.
You said like-minded. What was that? What was the things that – was it music? Was it a sense of trying to – rebel against the – what was it?
I think a little of both.
Yeah.
I mean, for certain, it was a common musical sort of interest and,
sure.
and a creative impulse, I think, that really sort of brought us together, as well as, you know, whatever deep social commentary, you know, 17-year-olds can muster.
Yep.
But certainly, you know, from my perspective, I think I think sometimes the social activist part of punk rock gets a little overplayed, but definitely you have those feelings of alienation and confusion when you're a teenager.
Did you get a sense that, and this is a, this appears a bit in the film, this idea that some of the kind of the anarchy or the rebellion was a reaction to conservative culture, conservative Mormon culture. Was that at all part of the way you were thinking?
Maybe, but, you know, I think probably sometimes the more things seem repressive, the more creative the response is.
Yeah.
I mean, I imagine there's probably, I mean, like, I'm a big fan of Rammstein, and those guys grew up behind the Berlin Wall, mm-hmm. and they're, you know, a pretty extremely entertaining band and pretty provocative, maybe not now as they were 20 years ago. But I bet there's, you know, amazing punk rock going on in Iraq or Syria or something analogous to it. So certainly I don't think any of us were raised in the LDS church. And, you know, we didn't go and play basketball at the ward after school. We played punk rock.
Yeah, yeah. So, what did you dress? What did you look like in your punkest of moments?
You know, I was never about the two-foot-high mohawk and the really outrageous, like, bondage clothes and stuff. I pretty much wore what I wear now.
Is that right?
Levi's and T-shirts and a leather jacket. I mean, that was about as extreme as it got for me. I was into the mod scene pretty intensely for a while. I had a scooter, and I'd wear little, you know, little suits and ties. But
well, the mods appear in SLC Punk. There's talk that you maybe were an inspiration for one of the figures there.
I can't speak to that directly because I've never talked to James Merendino about the film. Sean Fightmaster, before he died, told me that he identified with me as John the Mod because in high school I wasn't really that alienated. I was able to kind of get around with people and get along with people. And I wasn't ever coming from a place of, you know, extreme angst and anger about everything. More just it was more of a creative impulse and a social commentary aspect that I was interested in. Just the creative thing. I mean, my big influences growing up were, you know, Alice Cooper and glam rock and theater, and that all was part of the show. We never wanted to be a band that just looked like they walked on stage, you know? I mean, as much as I love the sort of grunge ethos, to us, to the Massacre guys, just walking on stage in a flannel shirt and Levi's would have been just, why? You have to, you know, put on some face
paint. Put on a show.
Put on a show. Make yourself a little bit different.
When you look back on it, what kind of influence did it have on the person that you became, if it did?
Well, That's interesting. I mean, I've always had an interest in social justice issues and equity, and that certainly plays into that. And also, I think I've always been a pretty good judge of character, and I'm pretty skeptical about things. So,
It seemed like the punk ethic was they hated phonies, right?
I think that authenticity certainly is a big part of that. And that's what was disappointing to me when it became just another sort of conformist collective thing. Everybody has the little Sid Vicious suit with the, you know, padlock around their neck and the leather jacket and it just becomes another sort of conformist thing rather than actually an authentic expression.
Yeah. What happened to punk?
I don't know. You know, it never went away. I think it's still there. And in a lot of ways, I remember, you know, at sort of the height of the Massacre Guys era, we were on a talk show with Rod Dekker. And he said, well, where do you see yourself, John, and, you know, in 30, 40 years? Do you see yourself becoming a respectable businessman? And I said, well, you know, I'll bet you that punk rock becomes a respectable business. And I think it has. You know, there's always a place for rebellious music, and that's what youth is all about. But in terms of, you know, I always kind of separated the fashion aspect away from the music.
But when you look back on being in that teeny scene that you were in, you must think about it fondly. Like that, I don't know, you must have an affection for those times.
Absolutely. Yeah. And for a lot of the people. You know, still, for the miracle of Facebook, a lot of those people I still stay in touch with. And, you know, it was a great little band. It was a fun scene. It got a little bit strange. You know, I wouldn't trade it for the world. It was a blast. And we had a lifetime of friends and had experiences that no other, you know, teenagers typically had.
It's John Schumann, former punk rocker, now prosecutor. He's still here in Salt Lake City. When we get back from a break, we'll talk with James Mirandino about his film, SLC Punk. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West and KUER.
Hey there, I'm Lee Hale, the host of KUER's new podcast, Preach. We dive into the messy reality of faith.
Faith is like riding a river. It flows.
My beliefs don't make any sense to me.
Sex and God, those are like huge things to be thinking about.
So whether you're someone who prays a lot or never prays or only prays when there's turbulence on the airplane, this podcast is for you. Find Preach wherever you listen to podcasts or at preachpod.org.
The film we've chosen for this month's film series is James Mirandino's feature, SLC Punk, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival 20 years ago. It's the story of Steve-O and Heroin Bob and an assortment of characters that made up a kind of counterculture in Salt Lake City in the 1980s, at least as James Mirandino saw it. He built the film around his own experiences in Salt Lake City. He grew up Catholic here on the fringe of the punk scene. We're going to be screening the film next week as part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We'll give you details about that a little bit later. James Mirandino joined us from NPR's studios in New York City. When did you first start thinking about writing this film? Like, what were the very first things that were coming to mind as you started? Well, clearly, it was, I mean, it's, I think it, Steve-O is you, sort of.
Yes.
So when did that occur to you to start writing something about a young man who's doesn't fit in very well into this interesting culture?
Well, I had made a movie with Michael Imperioli, and he had written a script with another guy named Victor, and it's called Anarchy in NYC, and they wanted me to direct it, and Spike Lee was going to produce it, and it was all going well, and we were negotiating, and then I don't know, something happened with my manager, had misrepresented something toward them, and so they thought that I didn't want to do it anymore. And then suddenly Spike Lee decided that he wanted to make the movie, and it became Summer of Sam.
Wow.
But in the conversations we had about being, there was very much about being a punk in New York City at that time when, you know, the Son of Sam was going around and killing. That was a theme in that script. And Michael and I had and Victor had talked about how poorly punks have been represented in movies. And Spike Lee had taken over. I said, "Well, I'm gonna write a story about something I know about." And at the same time, I had already written another script that Paramount had optioned, that was done in a style that's very similar to SLC Punk, but about going to Italy and Europe and all this other stuff. And so I took a little bit of the conversations I had with Michael Imperioli and some of the and then some of the stuff from the script that I had already written, and then a bunch of stuff that I had experienced myself, and I just sort of put it into this SLC Punk script. Because I was interested in playing with that structure of the unreliable narrator.
So you come up with Steve-O right away, and you think about your
Yeah, I mean, originally he was a character named Theodore in a script called Theodore, and he was another script about an unreliable narrator who narrates but isn't necessarily reliable in what he's saying.
Now, we should mention for those who know the film, so Steve-O, you actually used the name of someone who lived here for a while anyway, Stephen Edgerton from a band called Massacre Guys. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, now Stephen Edgerton is a very famous and amazing guitarist for the Descendants.
Yeah.
But he, I borrowed the name, sorry, and Bob as well. I mean, I initially put them in the script as placeholders, but then when we got to Utah, my producers just really liked the name, and I said, like, well, I thought I would change them, but our insurance company went around and got signatures and permission to go ahead and, even though those characters are not in any way specifically attached to those people's names. So, it just was, those names are just cool. And I didn't know those guys, but I really looked up to them. So, I thought, in my mind, I was sort of, it was a love letter to them and the entire community. That was what I thought I was doing.
Did they hang out, the two, Heroin Bob and Steve-O at the time?
I'm pretty sure they were really good friends. I know they were good friends. I didn't know them. I just know the names. I was younger than them, and I really did look up to them. I looked up to them, and I thought, so I just thought, in my own sort of humble way, I would homage them without, knowing anything about it. Like fan fiction. I didn't really think. I had a conversation with Steve right before I shot, and he had read the script, and he'd given me some notes, actually.
Is that right?
He's a good guy. I mean, I've never hung out with him, but I talked to him that one time on the phone, and I think we're Facebook friends. I like all his poets. He likes mine.
So Heroin Bob, people should know, is these days he's an Episcopalian priest?
No. The actual character that Bob is based on, the actual person, largely, although he's an amalgamation of other people, is a guy named Chris, who I went to school with, and he looked like Michael Gorgon.
I see.
They had the same coloring, hairstyle. Right. I mean, they both are very similar looking. If I could show a picture from the period, it's amazing how much they look exactly alike. And he was the one, Chris, is the one who punched a mirror ended up in quarantine, and my friends and I went to visit him, and that didn't happen to Bob, I don't think. I don't know what happened to Heroin Bob in real life, but that's what happened to Chris, and then I applied that story to the character Bob.
Talk a little bit about your what it was like growing up in Salt Lake City for a Catholic kid, what it was like.
I moved to Salt Lake with my family when we were seven.
Yeah.
I was really, I was ill prepared for the, because we're coming out of New Jersey. Yeah. I had never heard of Mormons, and I didn't know that they had such an effect. I really didn't know who they were. And in fact, when we got to Salt Lake, we drove past the temple there, and I really did think it was Disneyland. I thought there was going to be rides. And so, I don't know, growing up, so at first I was going to public schools, and they had, the Mormon religion had a surprising amount of influence over those schools. So we were a bit, I wouldn't say ostracized. I think that'd be an overreaction. But I felt we were definitely, the few kids that weren't Mormon were sort of picked out of the crowd. We were growing up in the foothills. And so eventually when it came to go to college, high school, I went to a Catholic high school called Judge Memorial Catholic High School. And as much as, I got hazed there, it was also great to be there, because then we all were experiencing similar weird reactions for not being Mormon heard.
What kind of aside from the religion part, what kind of a kid were you? Like, I think a lot of people have an impression that you were a punk, but that's not exactly right at all.
No, I mean, I'm not really a joiner, so I just sort of was just, I kept a lower profile, and it was more sort of, I just observed everything. I mean, I listened to the music. I went to the shows. I don't know what that makes me. I mean, I feel silly at my age to talk about whether I was a punker or a new waver or, I was a kid who wasn't listening to the music that the other kids in my school were listening to. Also, just not dressing the same way as everybody else. I mean, I don't know. It's actually not that big of a deal.
Yeah, but I think that people who see SLC punk or have impressions about what SLC punk is or was seem to be reacting to this idea of punk, like whether or not, whatever that means. Like, and I think that's part of the thing that's interesting about all of this is the film is really, I mean, you've talked about making no intention of making a statement about punk or trying to adjudicate the idea of what is punk or what isn't punk. So do you think that people who are connecting to the film, though, or connecting to this idea of anarchy or going against the grain. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can't speak for other people. I know that I was sort of, it's a yarn. I was sort of making a movie about something that I looked up to, or something that I was excited about. I also was trying to show people that outside of Utah or outside of small towns that there was a subculture in our town. Mm-hmm. Well, and so punk was a fairly large subculture that everyone could understand. I could have made it SLC goth, but at the time no one would really know what that meant.
Right.
Or SLC mod, or just punk kind of covered everything. And so I sort of talked about my personal experiences. I embellished, I exaggerated, I talked about a lot of people that were my friends, and then I just sort of spun this sort of fable about a counterculture in Utah that definitely existed, and then thought that would be interesting to reveal that exists in a small town like that.
Yeah.
I don't know, in terms of your initial question about, is it defining punk rock? I'm certain that has a different meaning for absolutely everybody.
Yeah.
In prisons, it means a very different thing than what it means to a person listening to a punk band.
You studied Western philosophy and theology, I saw, and I was wondering, why were you interested in religions? Were you interested in, the film is very philosophical, or Steve-O has the pretension of being philosophical anyway.
Yeah, but he's kind of an idiot. Yeah. I don't think that he. I mean, I don't know that any of his. He rants. He blathers on for a good hour and a half about things that, he's totally, his definitions are incorrect.
Yeah.
Particularly about anarchy. I don't know that he really understands what anarchy is.
Nazis always pissed us off. There were a few Nazi punks in town. Now, I don't know what the f*** these guys wanted. They had the shaved heads and wore the stupid little armbands. I mean, rebellion is one thing, that I understood. But there are some things that are just sacred. Not to mention the anarchy, a systemless society, which is what I wanted, no government, no rules. Well, that was the complete opposite of Nazi fascism.
But I studied philosophy because it was an interesting subject to study in Rome. I didn't study film at the time because, I'd seen a lot of movies. I wanted to maybe have a different perspective if I was going to make movies other than just other people's ideas of what a particular movie meant and how it was made. Philosophy, if you study that, you have a broader, it can introduce more themes that you could explore.
There's a this idea that Steve-O talks about in the film, he kind of has this grand plan, and it's hard to follow. I think, there's this, they want to get educated on one hand, but then waste their educated minds. He goes on, as you said, these kind of endless rants about anarchy, and I don't know, I just wondered, he comes across, I think a lot of people take Steve-O as the hero, but in some ways he's not really. As you said, he's just kind of an idiot sometimes.
Well, he's a kid. He's sort of, he's, he wants an, he's looking for an identity. So he, not any real person, but me, let's say that's me.
Yeah.
At that time, I certainly was trying to live a larger life and try to be, have an identity. And so I sort of, there's a little bit of a fabrication on his part,
mm-hmm.
to which I think a lot of young people do, and until he comes to an age to where he realizes that those philosophies that got him through school alive without being beaten to a pulp without any backup, when those no longer were convenient or no longer worked or fit with reality, he sort of dropped the pretense and just became who he was.
How was the? I think it's interesting. The looking back on the film now, the commentary you were making in 1998, 1999 about the 80s, and the kind of the hypocrisy that you seem to have perceived about the 80s. The hypocrisy of hippies, for example, voting Reagan into the White House. It seems like it was a pretty critical comment about maybe baby boomers or a certain generation.
I really didn't think any punk kids would watch the movie and like it. And it wasn't made for them. My audience was an older audience. And they had an oddly sort of nasty idea of what punk rock was. They thought that punks were guys with knives. They kept portraying them in movies as people that would rape women on subways. And I thought that was... I knew for sure that wasn't a thing. So I kind of wanted to just sort of say, look, they're just kids, and this is what they're like, and this is what they, you know, how they, some of them might think and behave and whatever. They're human. I wanted to humanize them. So I made the movie, and I made them to sort of say to that generation, to the baby boomers, that look, they're just as relevant as your youth culture was. So it just, you know, you just got to stop, you know, harping on it, because, you know, when you had your youth culture, you know, you were rebelling against something similar. The point wasn't taken by baby boomers at all. They marketed the movie back to kids. And then suddenly I was sort of, people thought I was trying to make this, to own punk rock or make a sort of stance on being an expert on what punk it meant. And then there was an argument ensued, and I don't know. That wasn't my point, but that's all right. You know, movies take on a life of their own.
But you're clearly frustrated about that. Like, it seems like artists who, if people don't get it, if they don't get the impression you were trying to convey, that's got to be frustrating.
Not really. I mean, I had, that wasn't my first movie. I had made several other movies and largely misinterpreted. I mean, you know, whatever your intentions are, oftentimes, the movie, you have to, at a certain point, that movie becomes a collaborative effort, and as a result, it takes on a life of its own, and in the end, it, people are going to, they're going to believe, they're going to see in it what they want. And then, on the other hand, also, the movie became a cult film. It wouldn't have become a cult film if it was just watched by baby boomers saying, oh, that's what punk is, or that's what those kids were doing.
Right.
And, you know, like, that. If it hadn't been taken up by the younger generation, then there'd be I wouldn't be talking to you right now about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, why did it become a cult film? Like, why?
I don't know.
You really don't understand that. You don't understand why it did.
No, I mean, honestly, I thought it was just going to be a little festival movie. It was a small movie. And I was just going to go to a few festivals like my other films. And I was going to have a discussion about it with other film people in that community. And then move on to my next little art film. I had no idea that it would be something that would be mainstreamed at all, or to the extent that it has been mainstreamed. I didn't think that, particularly on that movie, because it just wasn't any... There was no plot, and there was no real genre. I mean, except maybe a kooky comedy. I don't know what the... You know, I was... It was just sort of something I did.
But there's this evolution of a character who is trying to understand... It seems like he's going through these big questions about what's real and what's actually true. And
but as a storyteller, you know, when you sit down to write the script, I was just sort of going to, you know, sort of relay some anecdotes that I remember from when I was a kid about growing up in Salt Lake and some of the things that I did with my friends. And then it evolved into where you start, as a writer, you start to sort of project your own issues onto the character, and then eventually it becomes this sort of education of a young man. Other people would call it coming of age. I don't consider it that, but then he makes these realizations. I needed to wrap it up, you know. So as I was writing it, it took me 3 days to write it. So in those 3 days, it evolved from just putting down some vignettes into an arc, because if you're going to write, that becomes a natural part of your process. And then in the end, it made sense that he would leave, that his friend would die, and then he would then sort of realize that maybe some of his philosophy is not going to work later on in life. And then I realized that this movie was ultimately about class. And
whether you intended to or not?
No, I think that I have that attitude already, his privilege of wealth allowed him to escape that, you know, the character, you know, again, it's me. So he was able to escape the situation as soon as it got tough. He could take off the clothes and put on more conservative clothes and leave town, go to Harvard or wherever he wanted to go, because he had money, because he was born into it. Whereas his best friend was a poor kid who, that was his home, and that was always going to be his home. And, you know, and he ended up ODing, but he had an alcoholic father and all that stuff. So I mean, in terms of the tale, it is about class, about the reality of class and the class struggle. I just don't think that, and that was something that was intentional by the time I was, when I did the second draft. And I don't know that anyone really picked up on any of that. Though I think subliminally people do. I just don't think that it's clear to them that, yeah, that that's what's going on.
I want to ask how you handled Mormonism in the film itself. I mean, we see a few characters who are Mormon, sort of. You don't come right out and say a whole lot. I mean, there are references to the liquor laws and there are references to religious oppression, sort of, but it's not really a dominant theme. It's kind of a background or a setting. How are you? And one of the things you've also talked about is you weren't really that interested in bashing Mormonism or any faith for that matter. That seemed kind of boring to you.
I felt that would be wildly irresponsible of me to attack somebody's faith in a motion picture. I don't think that that's appropriate. And whether I agree with the dogma of that religion or not is irrelevant. It's people believe in it, and I just think it's a low blow. I wouldn't do it to any religion, so why would I do it to Mormons? I can disagree with the religion getting involved in the politics of the town. I made a very light suggestion about that, but I didn't want to specifically bash the Mormon Church in the open like that. That wouldn't be appropriate.
As a Catholic growing up, in
ironically, I grew up as a Catholic in a Mormon town, and the first thing I did is move to Rome, which is the seat of the Catholic Church. Yeah. You know, so,
did you feel oppressed? Did you feel like the faith was? Did you feel?
I've always said that I, at that time, I like to think that I was, but you know, it's fun to feel oppressed. But I mean, honestly, then I've gone around and I've met all the kids that aren't fitting in feel oppressed by the man. it's just that I don't know more in that town. I don't think Mormons particularly. Mostly were trying to convert me all the time. You know, I mean, I think they really want people to join the church. Whoever I was with, or my friends, or anyone with however crazy they looked, no one ever openly said, you know, you got beat up by a Mormon missionary because he had blue hair. You know, which is why, like in Wyoming, they go to Wyoming, and in Wyoming they're much more direct about being shocked by the way these kids look versus how they were acting in Salt Lake.
That was one thing I thought was interesting, and a really interesting insight about this culture, at least the way you perceived it, which is that Mormons are, I think, as you've described it, passive aggressive. That's what they were. They weren't judgy. They were passive aggressive. It seems.
Well, I hesitate to say Mormon as a dogmatic practice or passive aggressive, but I think that in some ways the culture is passive aggressive, and I think that for a lot of reasons, I think that it's necessarily part of the culture of the religion to be passive aggressive because of the struggles they had in this country to be recognized as a religion. They had to keep certain things quiet about what they did and what they were about, and passive aggressive is a form of lying. So I just feel like I'm sure people get mad that I say that, but I mean, I just think that there's a certain, first off, they have to, there's the element that they really try to live by, that they have to be forgiving and not judgmental, but it's still there. So that would create a sort of, you know, like, in, you know, if you can't tell somebody, I think you're an but you think it, then you become passive aggressive toward them.
Did you and your buddies ever go up to Evanston to get Mickey Big Mouth? And
absolutely, yeah. Yes, we did that all the time. Yes, one time I walked into a liquor store in Utah with a I had an idea and I scratched out the laminated part over my date of birth and I tried to change it. And I walked into a state-run liquor store and I showed him my ID and he noticed it and he tried to walk me back to arrest me and I just walked out of the store. So we stayed out of the state-run liquor stores and drove up to Wyoming to buy the stronger beer.
Yeah. I think if you grew up here, looking at SLC Punk, just some of those references, I don't know, they're fun to see. Just the place, I think this is such a, for someone who lives here and knows of these places, it's pretty fun to watch, I have to say, just on that level.
Well, I keep wanting people to point me to the movies that actually show that city, the skyline. It's a beautiful skyline. Like I don't know of many that have. I don't think I've really seen many at all.
Yeah.
Certainly not to the extent that that movie shows the city. And again, like I said before, it was like it's definitely like my attempt at a sort of glorification of the subculture in a small town. Like that, you know, and after the movie was made, I literally had to argue with people in the city, in like New York and LA and in England and other festivals I went to, that there was even this scene that existed because they didn't believe me. They just thought it was the only thing that happened in Utah were Mormons and maybe skiing. And I said, nope, there was this subculture. It absolutely happened. And eventually they started to accept that was a real thing. But that was sort of, I felt like, is the contribution that movie, if anything, it does suggest that city is not just as people on the coasts would think. It's a city filled with hillbillies. It's a city with people who have different ideas and different, mm-hmm. Thoughts and attitudes and are creative and are interesting. And whether you like the movie or not, at least it reveals it.
I want to ask you about a couple of scenes in the film. The film sort of portrays Steve-O's father is a successful lawyer, goes to Harvard, wants Steve-O to go to Harvard too, and it's interesting. Steve-O has the anarchist idea. He spouts the philosophy, but he gets good grades at school. And there's this moment when he, in one of his rants, when he asks himself, "Why did I do so well in school?
I didn't want to. I mean, I tried. I tried not to give a shit. I knew it was all and they were just trying to mold me into cannon fodder for their wars. And I knew that meaning lie elsewhere." But somehow I studied, somehow I got the grades, and now somehow I was accepted to a Ivy League school, last place on the planet.
I'd just like you to sort of take me through that scene and that moment as Steve-O's kind of, what, I guess, questioning his own motivations?
As an unreliable narrator, he's sort of putting on this sort of this bella figura, this sort of false pretense that he's this huge rebel, but to be honest, he's still the kid playing D&D in his garage, and he's still going to get good grades because he knew that he's not ignorant. He knows that if he's going to wants to be successful in life, he's going to have to be successful in school. That was ingrained in him by his parents. So his default setting was to obviously do well in school. And it's sort of it's a Freudian slip when he reveals that he did that, because if he was really dedicated to the crust punk lifestyle, mm-hmm. he wouldn't have even gone to college.
Yeah,
he would have he would have dropped out completely.
There's a moment later in the film where Steve-O is, I don't know, he's just tired of the scene, and he his philosophies, all these ideas that he's put together, as just a young kid, obviously, they're kind of falling away. The cycle, as he says, is getting old. He goes to these parties and he has these arguments, but the structure that he had for his life, or the way it's sort of conceived of things, was just sort of falling away. He's getting tired. He's getting depressed. He talks about this wave of melancholy. He gets attached to this woman. He has actual feelings. He's not as much the anarchist as he thinks he is. Right. What's going on with him there?
Well, I think that as I was presenting this story, I think that when you say seen, he really means his friends.
Yeah.
That he's starting to itch to get out of that town and to do bigger things than to just pretend to be poor and live and squat in an apartment somewhere that in reality probably his father was paying for. The act. I think he's getting over it. I think that he would rather do something with his life. So I don't know. I mean, it was convenient for the story, and now I'm looking back at it. So I mean, my opinion about these things have changed over the years, in terms of what my thinking was when I wrote the script. But I think that he was ultimately like, just because I was very anxious to leave Salt Lake.
Yeah. Well, he gets really violent with Bob when Bob just, or sort of violent anyway, just emotionally when Bob reveals, "Hey, this is not such a bad place. Maybe I'll stay."
And that's because Bob is sort of, he's defensive in that moment because he's not stuck like Bob is.
Right.
So his violent reaction is because it's basically, he interprets it as subconsciously as an accusation that he isn't really real. Mm-hmm. He isn't, you know, he's like, he has this outburst. It wasn't in the script. It's something I realized. And it's also a function of making the end more impactful, because I realized that I needed this sort of, before the scene when, you know, spoiler alert, Bob dies. before that scene, I felt like there was, they hadn't had a proper conflict. And I really wanted an extreme conflict. So you'll notice it's one shot. We just made it up on the spot. I told the actors where I thought they should go, and you know, Lillard went there, and it was it's my favorite scene in the movie. And it was really just to serve as a function to then be able to make the impact of Bob's death more, you know, be heavier because Steve-O had had this terrible fight with Bob.
Yeah.
I just started thinking, you know, Salt Lake ain't that bad, you know? You know what I'm saying? I know, I mean, I know it sucks and all, but, you know, this is like home, you know? What the fuck are you talking about? No, dude, all I'm saying is that, you know, if you think about it, no matter where you go, you gotta have a home. And Salt Lake is like, you know, it's home. This place is never going to be my home. No, I'm just saying.
No, it's, you said what you're going to say. Get it? Now you f***ing listen to what I'm going to say. Look at this f***ing place, right? It's a s***hole. Look out there, Bob. Tell me what you see. Nothing. Nothing piled upon f***ing nothing. It's like f***ing Jesus Christ took a s*** and it landed right here. So you can be happy all you f***ing want, all right? See, I used to think we were alike. I mean, we were similar. We had something together like this. You know what I mean? We thought alike. We felt the same way. But you, you. Grow up, Bobby, all right? Look around and grow up. Because I swear to God, man, I'll write you off like that. Is your home? You know what? Your home.
So wait, that moment just was improvisation in some way? It was something you conceived?
Yeah, it was completely. It occurred to me when I got there. I said, you know, we're about to shoot Bob's death scene where he's just lying there dead and Steve-O's reaction to it. And I realized, you know, Lillard's going to react to it. And so I realized, like, I'm missing a catalyst for this. I'm missing something real and something, you know, not funny or not something very stark that could then lead to this and so it wouldn't be so abrupt. And so I explained it to the guys and I said, I'm going to put the camera here and I'm going to say, Bob, I want you to say these things. And then Matthew, I want you to say like these things. And, and I said, let's do it. And they did it.
I love that story. I love the fact that you have these moments that you hadn't really counted on and they become really critical to this thing. It's just so interesting to hear someone talk about a piece of art, a film that we all look at in its completed form, and how you were working it out at the time. That's really interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have to be ready to work with your situation, because you don't have the money to just create, to shoot an extra week or to build an extra set or to fix it in post. You have to get it all. And so you have to be willing to adapt and also see where things might be missing and where you might need things. I mean, because in the end, you're going to go home and you're not going to be able to go back and pick up a scene. You have to shoot the whole thing when you're there. So I mean, yeah. So if you're on your toes, you reflect and then you say, boy, something's missing. So these actors were capable as hell. So they were able to bring it. And Matthew, I mean, he was fantastic in that scene.
There's this moment, and I'm sure I'm probably overthinking it, but it's when Steve-O meets Brandy, and
yeah,
there's this. I don't know, it's like this moment of revelation where she sees through him.
I have to ask you something.
Yeah, go ahead, ask me.
Well, why do you go out of your way to look like a bum?
I look like a bum?
Well, not in a bad way.
I look like a bum in a good way.
Aren't you, like, rebelling against society?
Put that simply, kinda, yeah.
Hey, Brandy! What's going on? What are you doing with this, huh?
Just see you later.
You were saying something about the way I looked.
Wouldn't it be more of an act of rebellion if you didn't spend so much time buying blue hair dye and going out to get punky clothes? It seems so petty. And stop me if I'm being offensive.
Oh, no, go right ahead. That's fine.
You want to be an individual, right? You look like you're wearing a uniform. I mean, you look like a punk. That's not rebellion. That's fashion.
Then what's rebellion?
Rebellion happens in the mind. You can't create it. You just are that way.
Right.
Well, I mean, that's a common, you know, sort of thing that thrown at people that dress funny. And I don't think she's entirely right. But so there's two ways of looking at it. Either that's my moment, where it becomes like a John Hughes movie and it's all sort of, you know. Or it's another class moment where she's a rich girl and he's a rich kid, and that's really what they see in each other. And what is he doing wearing this costume that's not who he is? For me, it just, it was, again, another way to sort of push him in a direction to becoming... not so dishonest about how he's trying to portray himself.
Yeah.
Though, I mean, I guess this is sort of how I'm talking about it now, because honestly, I don't think he's totally dishonest. I mean, I think he genuinely liked the music and everything. I just, you know, I think that he bailed. He bails at the end and gets out of it.
Why do you figure, James Mirandino, there haven't been many more films that have explored the sort of subculture of this place, of Salt Lake City? Does it that, as you said before, it's, they have a different impression about what the place is actually like?
Well, how many movies come out about the subculture of any small town? It'd be fun if they made, but I don't think they make that much money. I don't think that there's an incentive.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, like a lot of movies are coming out are like, maybe they need a superhero that's based out of Salt Lake. But I don't know. I mean, I would certainly, it'd be great if more filmmakers in Utah told their stories about Salt Lake.
Yeah.
Because I would watch them. And it'd be fun to watch, rather than just me being the only guy to do it.
Right.
Maybe they have more insight than I do and can do a better job.
James Mirandino, he wrote and directed SLC Punk. You can see it next Wednesday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. This, of course, is part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Mirandino will join us for a Q&A after the film, and you can get details about it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.